as does insurance on your home or car. With Freeze-Dry Guy, freeze-dried foods in your food reserve, you can be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. There has never been a better time to get a survival insurance policy of long-storing foods and preparedness supplies. Take the necessary steps to protect your family in these uncertain times. Visit www.freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663. Freeze Dry Guy pays the freight within the lower 48 states. Visit RBN's sponsor today. Ladies and gentlemen, we have John calling in from Tennessee. John, are you still with me?
I am. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Ladies and gentlemen, this is John, my favorite truck driver and listener. John is able to listen from the cab of his truck. John, go ahead.
Well, Tom and I are more than just radio friends. Tom and I are acquaintances, so just so people know. Tom, I was listening to your comments about the bunker, and I know that to many people this is a Tennessee thing. You know, why on earth would we be talking about it on RBN? You and I have had private conversations, and when you consider the formation of a world government and you consider the fact that this is basically a very upscale, isolated neighborhood where the average person would get a funny look, let me tell you, if you went into Oak Hill and you're in a 1982 Cadillac or a 1982 BMW or a 1990 car, you're going to be looked at.
This
is an area where the average individual isn't going to have access. And when you talk about the secrecy and the speed in which this was conducted, you have to ask yourself some questions. And basically, why are they doing it? If it's going on in Tennessee, let me give a warning to the other 49 states. Check out your state, check out your governor, check out your counties. Keep your eyes open and see what's going on, because this is, I believe, an implementation, a first step, although not a baby step. It's a first step at establishing a stronghold for a secret government. Now, you may not have wanted to say it, but I'll say it.
Go ahead, John.
See, did I lose you?
No, go ahead. You're right on target, John. And
you and I have discussed in private, Tom, the drawings, and it was actually a conversation between the two of us that spurred you. Tom Kovach was the first one in this area to get to the courthouse and to actually see the plans before the news media. Tom Kovach is the one that put the news media onto the layout of this place, and it was him and I that were talking, and Tom took the effort. Tom is a guy that we've mentioned before. I attack the attacker. Tom does the same thing. It's not because he's a superhuman. It's because he is a patriotic American. He knows that this nation is being taken incrementally, and he's doing everything he can to stop it, just like everyone else that's truly a patriot. And when we got out of the military, we didn't relinquish our oaths. We kept them, and we try our best to live by them. So I want to give you kudos, Tom. I won't take a lot of time. I get to talk to you anytime I want.
No, that's true, John. And
so I'll go quiet,
and
I'll let others call in.
You call me anytime, on the air, off the air, it doesn't matter. John, you are also a patriotic American. And
we're off the air.
Thank you for your call. And, it's not, as you said, it's not a superhuman effort. I'm only doing the kind of thing that they used to talk about in eighth grade American history class when I was young. But the problem is that nowadays in eighth grade American history class, they say things like, well, write an essay about how you feel about tea leaves floating on Boston Harbor and does it damage the environment? Like, give me a break. Just throw the tea leaves over the side of the ship and tell the British to go pound sand. But we don't do that anymore. Everybody just sits back and takes it. And John made a great point, and that is that this case does have nationwide implications. Why? because how much can politicians get away with? How much can they violate the law? How much can they violate the Constitution? How much money can they take out of your pocket? And out of 11 million citizens in the state of Tennessee, how many will stand up and file a lawsuit? So far, just one. Now, I don't say that to blow my own horn. I say that as a matter of, well, where are the other 10,999,099 taxpayers? Come on, let's get going. There is a great legendary story from military history. I don't know if this story is true. That's why I said it's a legendary story, but it's one that has inspired generations of soldiers, and that is, in the Battle of the Bulge, the Americans were pinned down by the Nazi reinforcements. It was snowing. Things were looking bleak. Armor was coming, and then one ranger stood up from his ditch, waved his arm, and said those classic words that are painted on a sign on the side of the road at Fort Benning, Georgia. I've been there, and it says, "Follow me." Now, ladies and gentlemen, follow me. Get up off the couch. Get down to the courthouse. File a lawsuit. Go downtown. Honk your horn. Do whatever it takes. Surround the state capitol. Tell these people enough is enough. There is a saying, as Nashville goes, so goes the nation. And I can tell you that if Governor Bredesen gets away with this in Nashville, Tennessee, it might be your state capitol next. So don't laugh it off and say, oh, well, it's only happening in Nashville. Those bumpkins there, they'll fight about anything. No, not so. And the sad fact is, it seems that lately they fight about nothing. Because I don't see anybody standing beside me in this fight so far. The rich people don't want to talk to me. But thank God John Stadtmiller had enough foresight to be able to say, wow, this guy took on the governor of the state of Tennessee all by himself. I have a talk show slot open. Let's see what this guy can do. So that is where we stand right now. The case has been dismissed. The specific reason, now those of you in Tennessee pay particular attention, but this applies, you might want to check your state laws in every other state in this nation, but the doctrine that was used in order to dismiss the case was a little known statute, and the judge even said that the statute is little known. Even public officials of the county in which the case was filed have come into this courtroom and filed lawsuits against the state, and the public officials, some of whom are attorneys themselves, had their cases dismissed under this same statute. And the statute says that if you sue the state of Tennessee, you can only sue the state of Tennessee in Chancery Court in Davidson County, which is Nashville, the state capital. I live in the next county over, and I sued in the county where I reside. Now, many of you in the most educated audience in talk radio already know that under normal courthouse rules, venue lies with the plaintiff. In other words, I live in Wilson County. I sue in Wilson County. I don't sue in Davidson County because that's where the defendants are. I sue here because I'm the plaintiff and this is where I am. So, if this works, if they get away with this, if I don't get the support needed to file an appeal, then not only do I lose this particular lawsuit, but every taxpaying citizen in the state of Tennessee that does not live in Davidson County gets the courthouse door slammed in their face. So that is a huge problem. And we'll see whether or not we can get support from the listeners of Republic Broadcasting Network, because, as I say, although this case is happening in Tennessee, this has nationwide implications. And, John, you be safe out there on the road, because I thank you for your call. This, as you pointed out, is definitely a case that has nationwide implications. And I'm a little disappointed because I wrote a column for WorldNet Daily, and they've published several of my columns, but they didn't publish that one. And somehow, that watchdog news agency, I was a bit disappointed that they did not bring up this topic to a national audience. This is not merely a neighborhood dust-up in South Nashville, as Governor Bredesen has tried to say. Governor Bredesen has tried to spin this issue and say that, oh, this is just some local neighbors that are worried about the blasting. That's all it is. Well, when that didn't work, then he said, well, this is a partisan issue, and most of my neighbors are Republicans, blah, blah, blah. Then he said, now they're trying to throw dirt on the First Lady, blah, blah, blah. Well, if it's throwing dirt to say that the First Lady is not a state official, then what is the First Lady throwing at us? I think it's about the same color as dirt, but it isn't dirt, and I don't want her to throw any more of it. So the only way to stop these people at this point is a lawsuit. The state of Tennessee has and has had since 1875 three things: a Democratic majority in the House, a Democratic congressional representative, an overwhelming Democratic majority in the local population, and also up until just a couple years ago, they also had a Democratic majority in both houses of the state legislature. The Republicans now have a one-seat majority in the state Senate. However, that is in constant jeopardy for various reasons. And so the lieutenant governor, to his credit, and in Tennessee, the lieutenant governor in the state of Tennessee is the Speaker of the Senate. So in other words, in some states, you get a ticket such as president and vice president, where you have a governor and a lieutenant governor. That's how it's done in New York, for example. It's a ticket. But here in Tennessee, the governor runs on his own line, and then the lieutenant governor is elected from the members of the Senate. Lieutenant Governor Ron Ramsey is the only opposition member on the State Building Commission, six members. They voted 5-1 on Thursday. Go ahead, this project. There is now nothing left to stop the predatory monster being built. Ladies and gentlemen, I hear the break music. We will be back after this short interlude on the Republic Broadcasting Network. You're listening to the U.S. Phone Force. My name is Tom Kovach. Lord knows where we'd be when it comes to heroes, renegades alike.
pass away. But life presents us possibilities each and every day. I heard a calling that was right for me. I prayed for strength for what's ahead of me. Show me the way. Please show me the way. The sun rose high and burnt the night away. Who stood before me was my enemy. He's come to take away my liberties. I'd rather die than be a slave to thee.
Don't treat me this way.
I'd rather die than be your slave. I will survive. Can you feel my rage? It's not a question. They killed my brothers, they lay dead by me. Hit them hard, we made them pay that day. We hung the traitors from the highest trees.
Mercy from me.
Lost a lot, our pain was heavy. We sacrificed for God and country.
No more calling.
Still held the ground that was in front of me. This was the price to pay for liberty.
Still you hear me say,
I'd rather die.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're back now on the Republic Broadcasting Network with the U.S. Phone Force. My name is Tom Kovach. While we were on the break, I got this email from Thomas in Arizona. Please don't take this wrong, but start taking calls and find better content. This story is marginal at best. National issues are better for a show. Now, Thomas, I am deeply sorry that you didn't pick up on the national implications of this earlier on when you called. But this story has national implications, as I just explained after John's call from Tennessee. But don't worry, I did do my homework, and on a national program, we do have nationally known guests. One of them is on the line with us now. He is a world-renowned, nationally known author and columnist, documentary producer. You probably already know who I'm talking about, but just in case you don't, he writes a regular column on Thursdays for WorldNet Daily. He has produced a documentary, videos, Silenced, and First Strike. He's the author of the books First Strike, Ron Brown's Body, among others. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome to the U.S. Phone Force, Jack Cashel. Jack, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, honor to be your guest.
Jack, you have going right now, and you've done so many hot topics over the years. I am stunned, and you are my role model when it comes to research. Man, I'll tell you what, I would if I was in a casino and you were dealing blackjack, I would go to the next table immediately, because when you pull that first card, I already know that you know what the hand's going to be 4 hours from now. So when I start reading an investigative series written by Jack Cashel, I know that in the first paragraph or two, a question is going to pop up in my mind. And when I get to part four, I'll begin to get the answer to that question. You do so much research. And this topic, Jack, nobody else is touching this, as with many of your topics over the years. Tell us, what is so important about who these candidates pick as their advisors, and in particular, the interesting juxtaposition between the national security advisors for Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama?
Well, you know, what happens is that when candidates run for a given office, you know this, they scramble to grab as advisors those people with experience who will give their campaign credibility.
Well, that makes sense on the surface.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and six months a year ago, whatever, everyone presumed that Hillary would win, and she still may, but so she secured the services of all of the heavy hitters from the Clinton administration, virtually all of them, I should say. And they included, like, Wesley Clark, Richard Holbrooke, Madeleine Albright, and as well as some of the more dubious ones, like Sandy Berger and Joseph Wilson. And so there wasn't much left for anyone else, but Obama came up with, as his top guy, Richard Clark. Not to be confused with General Wesley Clark. Richard Clark was the guy who wrote Against All Enemies, which came out in 2004. Which is personally, I think, one of the most dishonest and treacherous books ever written.
And
for the 8 years of the Clinton administration, he was the head of their they call the CSG, was the Counter Terrorism Security Group, and basically he was their anti-terror czar. And he's a blowhard and a liar, and it's hard to tell one from the other. Yet at the same time, he can be remarkably indiscreet. And Tom, I think, you know, and I would encourage your readers to think in that, your listeners to think in this term, some of the best information out there is obvious information. It's in their books. I mean, no one thinks to read the memoirs of these people. You know, they don't see that as a source of information, but it's often a gold mine, especially if you read them all and you start cross-comparing, you know?
Exactly. And you've
and
done a
Clark's
magnificent
case,
job.
You know, when you read his book, and his book came out in March of 2004, and if you remember, he got like full 60 minutes on 60 minutes, and he testified before the 9/11 Commission, and he used his testimony to thoroughly discredit the Bush administration, to blame them for not only for 9/11, but for he claimed their negligence led to 9/11, but also he argued that they staged the Iraq War so that Bush could be reelected in 2004. He makes that argument. Now, say what you will about President Bush, and I know that not everyone is totally fond of him. He does not deserve this kind of defamation, and especially since there's so much at stake. You know, and the whole future of the country is at stake.
As I've said many times over the years, and it's an especially popular phrase in the military, the worst shots come from behind.
And, yeah, that's exactly right.
And regardless, as you said, regardless of one's views of President Bush, Richard Clark was one of his key advisors on national security and terrorism, and he's shooting his boss from behind.
That's exactly right, because Bush kept him over. And in fact, Richard Clark is right now is like the poster child for why you should not or cannot hold over someone from the previous administration, especially after what happened, as you know, Tom, is that after that 2000 election, the other side was so deeply bitter and spiteful. And don't think that wasn't any different in the CIA and the State Department than it was around your local water cooler.
Okay.
And what a lot of people don't understand is that the CIA and the State Department are historically liberal. You know, these aren't conservative organizations. And they, you know, if you go to their parking lot, to just, you know, in 2000, you're going to see all those, you know, Gore Lieberman bumper stickers, you know?
Exactly. And Jack,
and they were so
spiteful after just so incredible
that they continue to eat away from within in the government. And, you know, that would be, you could say, well, that's, you know, they have their right. Sure they do, but when we got troops in the field after September 11th, then that became a form of just of treachery. You know, they were traitors. And it's hard to get around that word.
And that's a word that serious writers like you, Jack, don't bandy around loosely.
No,
I mean, the title of the first part of your series is Will a Traitor Head Obama's CIA?
Right, and actually,
that comes
that
right
the,
to the chase.
That was WorldNet Daily's choice, but I didn't disagree with them. I thought that was a fair estimate, because you know if he were protesting on the basis of principle, you know, it'd be one thing. But what he's doing in his book is he is so wrong so often and so conspicuously in so many different ways. The real challenge is to sort out when he's being just careless and when he's being consciously deceptive, because he's so often wrong. And what makes this essential, critical now is that Clark could very well be our next national security advisor or director of central intelligence should Obama prevail in November. And, for instance, Annalise, just give you some instances of where he's factually wrong in his book. And this is scary for a guy at that level. On at least three occasions, for instance, in the book, he tells the reader that Pan Am 103, the one that blew up over Lockerbie, was destroyed in 1989 during the first Bush presidency. Three times he repeats that. You know, he was in the State Department at that time. He was an up-and-comer. You'd think that he would know that it happened in 1988 when Ronald Reagan was president. That makes
exactly
a big difference.
Before the end of Ronald Reagan's term.
Yeah. And then he talks about the armed intervention in Lebanon in 1982. And he ties it into our concerns about Iran. It had nothing to do with Iran. We
right.
intervened essentially to oversee the PLO evacuation to Tunisia, which we did successfully. Then we stuck around longer than we should have, because that set us up as a sitting target there, and they proceeded to, if you recall, blow up the Marine barracks, kill 200-something people.
Exactly.
But,
we stayed to supervise the regime change, and we should have not stayed so long, as you mentioned.
Yeah, right. We should have just done our job and gotten out of there, if we'd gotten in there at all. Then he makes the totally bizarre claim, and this is a quote, that President Clinton had defeated al-Qaeda when it attempted to take over Bosnia. Now, this is one of the great untold stories of our time, our involvement in Bosnia, which was real nation building, which had a totally gratuitous nation building. And not only were we nation building, we were nation building for the wrong guys. We set up, essentially, we allowed al-Qaeda to establish a beachhead in Europe, and they're still there. We allowed Iran to import arms into Bosnia, you know? We were fighting for the Mujahideen, not against the Soviet Union, which is understandable, but against Serbia, you know, which has, no terrorist arm. It has no grudge against the United States. It has no ambitions against other countries. It has no weapons of mass destruction. Why were we fighting Serbia,
Jack, if I can just take a quick side note, this is something that I've written about in some of my columns. And as I pointed out in those columns, Bill Clinton got us into what was essentially a three-sided religious war.
Right.
Now, the lamestream media kept using the term ethnic cleansing, but the Bosnians, the Croatians, and the Serbians ethnically are all the same. They are called South Slavs.
Right.
The language that they speak is all the same. The difference between the countries, Bosnia, Serbia, and Croatia, the Croatians are Roman Catholic Christians. The Serbians are Orthodox Christians, and the Bosnians are Muslims. So
right.
Bill
Clinton... They all look alike.
Got us into a war, a religious
right.
war, three-sided, on the side of the only country that is not Christian.
Right. Not only that, but the Croats were allies with the Nazis in World War II. The Serbs were the only good guys in World War II. And plus, they have great basketball players, that was crazy. And for instance, if you want to see how lying, people talk about, Bush lied, people died. I'm going to say that's a nonsense charge based on historical records. In Kosovo, when we went into Kosovo, if you recall, I would challenge your listeners to go to Google, put in the word 100,000, and then go to Kosovo. And,
right.
and then you'll find all of these Clinton officials saying that there were 100,000 Kosovars who had been dumped into mass graves, right?
Right.
And so we bombed Serbia during the Kosovo stage in 1998. To stop the genocide, the Holocaust that was going on. Well, after the war was over, the international relief teams went in to dig up the mass graves.
Right.
And they found none. There were a total of something like 600 Kosovars who had been killed, and virtually all of them had been killed in fighting, you know.
Wow.
There's no 100,000. The State Department at one point said there were 500,000. Clinton himself said scores of thousands and compared it to the Holocaust. A total fraud. A total media-generated fraud. And that was what when real lying was going on. But anyhow, get back to Clark. Okay, then he writes in his book, you know, first of all, this incident is important because it's really the beginning of the American Jihad, is when they killed this guy named an Egyptian called El Sayed Nasser. He murdered the Jewish leader Meir Kahan in New York.
I remember that. Was assassinated, machine gunned in a van in Brooklyn, as I recall.
Yeah, that's right. And it was, you know, it's a critical date because it launched the bringing of the jihad to America, and it took place in 1990. I mean, that's critical. Now, here you are, the top anti-terrorism czar, and you write in your book that it takes place in 1992. And there's a reason that he pushes it back, because he ties this to Osama bin Laden, who's his own, you know, his own obsession.
Right.
And that way, because in 1992, he can make the case that this was part of Osama bin Laden's deal, but it wasn't. You know, I mean, Osama bin Laden was, no one even knew who he was in 1990, you know,
right.
Let alone 1992. And, you know, so and if these miscues can be blamed on carelessness, the same can't be said, and this is really critical to understand. I think for people who don't understand about World Trade Center 1, it's very difficult to get a handle on World Trade Center 2. And on this grounds, Clark has been consistently, you look at his role in talking about the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, and you've got to believe that his role was as the fixer, the one who changed the story, because he would perfect this 3 years later with the destruction of TWA Flight 800, which is really critical to understanding what
right.
Clark is all about. But just for the, in a way of background, to refresh people's memory, this was on, I believe it was February 26, 1993, Ramzi Youssef, Abdul Rahman Yassin, and four or five other guys, they drive their van loaded with explosives into a corner underneath the World Trade Center. Youssef's and the bombs tipped with cyanide. Youssef's goal is to structurally undermine the one building and knock it into the other. He had hoped to kill 250,000 people. This is a serious act of war, right?
Yes, it is.
And there's a few things that have to be understood about it. One is that on the day it took place was the second anniversary of Iraq's humiliating retreat from Kuwait 2 years earlier.
Right.
And these people are very anniversary conscious. Youssef was, his nom de guerre was Rashid the Iraqi. He had he was traveling on an Iraqi passport, and his trip had started in Baghdad. Yassin, his co-conspirator, was an Iraqi who left Baghdad to come to America right around the same time Ramzi Youssef did. Okay? Now, this would give you cause to think maybe there's an Iraqi hand in this operation, you know? Then what they did, of course, is they rounded up the yokel locals who had a grudge against the government and got them to mix the chemicals and stuff. At the end of the day, Youssef and Yassin are the only ones who leave the country successfully. Youssef goes back to, he goes all over the world, basically. I think they end up capturing in Pakistan several years later. But Yassin goes to back to Baghdad. And there he gets a government apartment and a job, and he stays there for the next 10 years, right?
Right.
So you've got to think that that maybe Iraq had a hand in this, or they were certainly sympathetic to it. And now, just 5 months earlier, when you know Al Gore was on the stump, running against Bush Senior, you know he blasted him for not paying enough attention to the terrorists that Saddam was harboring, and in Iraq. And he was right. I mean, there was Abu Nadal was there, Abu Abbas was there. He cited a figure of 1,400 separate terrorists that Saddam was hosting and running, and it's quite likely that included Yassin and Youssef, you know, and this was probably an Iraqi intelligence job. It made sense. All the FBI people thought so right at the shoot.
Right.
There's a problem, though. This now, Clinton's been president for a month. By the way, there had been another terrorist incident even before that, when the guy, the Pakistani, shot and killed three CIA agents outside the gates.
I remember that.
And that one, they deep-sixed that story also. Because if Iraq was behind the World Trade Center bombing, the first one, that would have meant we would have had to go to war, or something very much like it. And that's the last thing Clinton wanted to do. It was the thing that he was unsteadiest with, you know, where he had no confidence in his role as commander-in-chief, and no one else had any confidence in him either.
Well, how could he, when he's on record as saying that he loathes the military?
Yeah, exactly. And the military knew that, you know. And so what they did is they turned it into a, you know, police job, you know, turned it over to the FBI. But then they had a deep investment in making it something other than Iraq involvement. And that was Richard Clark's job, and it has been his job ever since. Now,
Jack, before you go on, let me interject here at one point just to cement the idea about the Iraqi involvement, and that is that you did a great job in one of the segments of your columns regarding linking this presence of this terrorist that goes by a couple of names, Yasmin, I think it was.
Yeah.
You do a great job of linking his presence in Baghdad to that of Abu Abbas.
Yeah, Abu Abbas and
state
Abu
supported
Nadal, you know?
For many years in Baghdad, and then, according to news reports, supposedly committed suicide at one point. And I like to dub that a Mossad-assisted suicide.
Sort of like an Arkansas.
Very good, exactly. Very similar
the
to an Arkansas,
Arkansas
in the Middle East.
You know? you're right. And Abu Abbas, this is the guy who killed the American Leon Klinghoffer, dumped his wheelchair off a cruise ship. He was traveling on an Iraqi diplomatic passport, you know. But so we had to make believe that Iraq had nothing to do with this. And this was a government policy, and that was Richard Clark's job, to fix things for the Clintons. He was such a stuck-up. Now, and this would come in handy years later, because after we go into war with Iraq, then we could, you know, the same argument would be that, why are we going to war with Iraq? They never did anything to us, you know. Then we could manufacture that fiction. And then, you know, Bush lied, people died, you know, and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
But look for Iraqi hand. Boy, their intelligence service was a lot more sophisticated than people give credit for, because what they could not afford to do was to tip their hand, you know.
Exactly.
They couldn't be obvious about it. They'd rather work through proxies.
The funny thing is, Dick, that if you and I can access information like this, and you've done a magnificent job of the research and the contacts and the sources and everything, and that all of the reading required to, as you said, cross-compare their memoirs, if this is what we can glean from the public record, imagine how much more information was actually available to Clark via his official sources that we will never see because they're so highly classified. And therefore, the skewing of the facts in his book is even more severe, because there's no way that this guy didn't know these very key facts. And as you conclude, he has essentially buried them and tried to ignore the Iraqi connection to these terrorist acts, has therefore undermined our efforts in our war with Iraq, which my big objection here is that, unfortunately, it was not a constitutionally declared war, but that's Congress's fault for not exercising their own authority. I do agree that we should have invaded Iraq, but I don't think we need to be engaged in nation building.
And this is, you know, that would be, I agree with you about both of those. Although I would say, and this is to the critics of the Iraq War, and I'm sure there are some in your audience, the notion of nation building in this case wasn't gratuitous. You know, it wasn't like we said, well, let's go into a country and, you know, where the leader is mean, throw him out and try to build a nation. This was like, okay, I was the only one I knew who, after the first Gulf War, said we shouldn't have gone to Baghdad, because I think Colin Powell was right. He says, if you break it, you own it. You know, I mean, if you break it, you got to do something. You know, you got to put something there. You know, so that's where you know, I think they, well, that's another story, but.
Absolutely, but the point being that I just want to underscore that someone as insidious as Richard Clark in skewing these facts is trying to mislead the American people, and if he's doing that, having had access to all this information, and now he's a private citizen, advisor to Barack Obama's presidential campaign, what will he do? And this is the ultimate question of your investigative series. What could this man do as the head of the CIA or some other high office, such as director of the NSA, if he is in stalled into the government of either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton? And
well,
if
then,
I may...
Good, right, and I think what we'll see what he'll do, I think he'll continue to play that role of fixer. And let's jump ahead, Tom, to 1996 and July 17th, 1996. Which just happened to be, inconveniently for the Clinton administration, National Liberation Day in Saddam's Iraq. It was their evil 4th of July. And on that day, Saddam had made his most virulent anti-American speech ever, right? It just so happened that same night, after a very direct and specific warning came in, TWA Flight 800 was blown out of the sky off the coast of Long Island. 230 people were killed. Now, Clark is extremely indiscreet about this. He's the only one who writes about it. Which is fascinating, and I got a hats off to Richard Clark for at least bringing up the subject. And just to give your audience a sense of how deeply this story has been suppressed, Clark dedicates about 20 pages to it, and he calls it the Almost War 1996, in which he argues, and I think somewhat truthfully, that when the plane went down that night, he convened a meeting of the, you know, the counterterrorism security group in Washington, all the in the Situation Room. The president was there upstairs in the family quarters. This is all true. This doesn't happen after the average plane crash, by the way.
Right.
They knew something had happened. And what Clark said was that we had drawn up, after the destruction of Khobar Towers 3 weeks earlier, killed 19 American servicemen in Saudi Arabia, a plan called the Eisenhower Option, in which we were going to make a massive retaliation against Iran if there was ever another provocation like this. We believed that Iran was behind the Khobar Towers. And so he dreaded that option, as everyone did. And so when he drove back into Washington that night, he was thinking, my gosh, this is terrible. We're going to have to go to war. And then he argues that for the next month or so, he and the president and everyone believed that terrorism was responsible for the taking down the plane. As late as a month after the crash, 5 weeks after the crash, the New York Times was running headline stories saying conclusive evidence found that, you know, explosive device destroys TWA Flight 800. So we were in a state of near war for 5 weeks, at least. Now, here's that. Then, and this is just before the presidential election. The president goes up to Long Island. He meets with the family members. Hillary goes with him. She meets with the family. This had to be the most traumatic part of the Clinton presidency. And then you have to see, how is it covered in the other memoir, right?
Right.
Dick Morris gives it two words. He calls it the terror summer of 1996. He calls it a terrorist act and says no more about it. George Stephanopoulos, in his memoir, not a word. George Tenet, at the time the assistant director of Central Intelligence, and the director of Central Intelligence when the investigation is going on, not one word. Louis Freeh, head of the FBI, two sentences. Hillary Clinton, one-third of one sentence. Bill Clinton, in his 900-page memoir, My Life, gives it one paragraph. He spent more time talking about a trip to Albuquerque a week before to talk about curfews for teenagers than he does about the Almost War 1996. This story has been deep sick. Clark didn't get the memo. He talks about it, you know. He lies about it, but he talks about it.
Well, you know, it's funny when you say he didn't get the memo, because the story is so significant that the Flight 800 story almost single-handedly took WorldNet Daily to the top of the Internet news charts.
Yeah.
Because WorldNet Daily was the one that would not let go. This fierce little bulldog independent Internet news organization grabbed onto that story, researched the facts, gave you and James Sanders and later on Captain Lair and then eventually myself also room to be able to investigate, and gave us a forum for that. And,
well, and you're absolutely right, Tom. And because I'll tell you what happened in the other mainstream, in the conservative public. I used to write for the Weekly Standard, you know.
Right.
And then I started writing about CWA 5800, and they dropped me.
Wow.
And that's not unique. What happens is, I'll, you know, it's interesting, and I can't name names, but I will say this, that I've gotten, I've raised this story very high up some flagpole, you know.
Right.
And I'll get the people interested. People, you know, that are household names within the conservative movement, okay?
Right.
And they'll be, like, totally flabbergasted, you know? And they'll be utterly intrigued, you know? And then I get them in a little further, and then I'll say, can you talk to X about this? Now, the X in question will be someone in a very high level of government, right?
Right.
Can you talk to X about this? And they'll say, yeah, boy, I have to alert the, I have to alert them, you know? And then this has happened three times, three different occasions. And the X is in question, you know, I can't mention, but we'll just talk. These are people who run the government. And in all three occasions, the conversation just ends. You know, the flurry of emails and phone calls ends. They don't call back and tell me, well, you know, I talked to X, and X said, no, this is all BS. No, I just don't never hear back again. Right, and then maybe a month later we can resume the conversation on something else. But this story is over, right? It ends. For instance,
exactly.
I was on a radio show with Dick Morris.
That story has such long-lasting implications, as you've pointed out in the case of Richard Clark.
Right.
And then let's take a parallel example here from the campaign of Hillary Clinton, and she has as her national security advisor Sandy Berger.
Honestly.
Now, I wrote a column in Men's News Daily. It was one of the last ones I wrote for them. And the title was, Did Berger Fry the Records of Flight 800? Because to this day, the general public does not know what documents specifically Sandy Berger purloined from the National Archives. We know that he did it. He finally admitted that he did it. He went so far as to explain, you know, how he put them in his pants and made the drop and
Right. Hid
them underneath something, and et cetera, et cetera. We know that he took documents, but the problem is that the documents were so highly classified that even the inventory of the documents is top secret. And so,
no, you're absolutely right. They don't even know. They don't know.
We have no idea what is missing, and my speculation, and I'll admit that it's only speculation, but it makes perfect sense. The long-lasting implications, I would assume that he probably purloined perhaps the minutes of that very meeting that you described of the CSG,
yeah,
in which they discussed the terrorism aspects of the downing of Flight 800. And
yeah, I think you're entirely on the right track. I would get even more specific. And here it's have you talked to Buzz Patterson, Colonel Buzz Patterson?
I spoke with him very briefly about 3 years ago, I believe.
You know, I got to know him. He's a really sharp guy. He's so laid back and fun. I mean, he carried the nuclear football for the president.
Yes, and he wrote the book about that.
And what he says is that in the summer of 1996, after TWA Flight 800 went down, he was carrying papers from the Oval Office back to the National Security Council, and the president had them opened on his desk, and he was carrying them, and the president had his handwritten notes on them, and they were the plans for Operation Bojinka.
Oh.
Now, Bojinka was the plans drawn up by Ramzi Youssef, the first World Trade Center bomber, and his uncle, who was probably just his collaborator, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the architect of 9/11. Basically, it was the sort of a trial. It was sort of the prototype of 9/11. They were going to use airplanes to attack American targets. And there's a pilot, Patterson was, all eyes, you know, and he's reading this, and he saw the president's notes on this. Well, as soon as I read that, I called Patterson. I said, when in the summer of 96 was this? Because, you know, Flight 800 took place on July 17th, and these plans had been in Washington since January of 95 when the Filipino police turned them over to us.
Right.
And he said it was, all he could say was late summer. In other words, it was after Flight 800 went down. And I said, you know, I'm thinking that here are the Bojinka plans in the president's hands 18 months after they've come into the country, right? And what if he writes on them and he goes, how does this relate to TWA Flight 800, you know? Can we link this? Can we do that or something, right? And when Berger goes into the files, now the Bojinka plans in themselves aren't damning. What's damning are the president's notes on those plans. And when Berger goes into the files, he says he took only three copies of, you know, not he didn't take all five copies, he just took three of the five. Now, Washington Post says, why would he take just three? Well, the answer to me is obvious. The ones that are problematic are the ones with the president's handwritten notes on them, you know? And I think, absolutely you're right, Tom, I think it had to do with purging TWA Flight 800 from the record. Now, once that's purged from the record, you can't talk about aviation security anymore. You have to drop that subject. Because if you talk about it, then Flight 800's bound to come up. So for the next 5 years, there is no talk about Bojinka's, about the plans to attack America with airplanes. That's dropped from the repertoire of conversation. When Richard Clark goes before the 9/11 commission, they ask him. They said, did you tell the incoming administration about al-Qaeda plans to attack America using airplanes? And he says, well, you know, you'll forgive an old intelligence hand. You know, we saw some talk about that about 5 years ago, now, you know, before 9/11, referring back to Bojinka. But, you know, we didn't see any more about it, so we let it drop. He admits as much. First question they ask Condoleezza Rice, did the incoming outgoing administration tell you about, you know, the plans to use planes as bombs? She says no. And she's right, because they didn't. They couldn't. Same thing with Al Gore's Aviation Security Commission. Couldn't talk about that. He let that drop, you know, because to get into that would have been to acknowledge that Flight 800 was not a mechanical failure like they said.
Exactly, and that's the undoing of this entire lineage of the Clinton legacy, and
yeah. That's
why I applaud you for not letting go of it and for showing this connection. Now, we have to do a short message here to pay the light bills here at Republic Broadcasting Network, and I want to get back to this and the aviation security angle and then tie that back into your investigative series for WorldNet Daily, because when I read that, Jack, I was just amazed. You have followed breadcrumbs on this and shown that there are so many national security implications. And, of course, the bottom line is you told us what we already know, and that is, don't trust Barack Obama, and definitely don't trust Hillary Clinton. We'll be back after this. Lord knows where we'd be when it comes to heroes, renegades alike. RBN has a new sponsor, Freeze Dry Guy. Freeze-dried foods typically maintain their high nutritional value in excess of 30 years. Why store emergency food? Keeping food on hand for emergencies protects you the same way as does insurance on your home or car. With Freeze Dry Guy, freeze-dried foods in your food reserve, you can be ready for just about any unexpected crisis. There has never been a better time to get a survival insurance policy of long-storing foods and preparedness supplies. Take the necessary steps to protect your family in these uncertain times. Visit www.freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FREEZE. food. That's 866-404-3663. Freeze-dry guy pays the freight within the lower 48 states. Visit RBN's sponsor today. And ladies and gentlemen, we are back with our guest, nationally known author, columnist, and documentary producer, WorldNet Daily's Jack Cashel. Jack, before the break, we talked about aviation security and how the implications of the wake of the Flight 800 downing have implications all the way to the 2008 presidential campaigns, and especially the campaigns of Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. Now, your investigative series of WorldNet Daily is about Richard Clark, who has recently been named as the National Security Advisor for the Barack Obama campaign. And we touched briefly on the fact that Sandy Berger has recently been named as the National Security Advisor for Hillary Clinton's campaign. And then just before the break, we discussed the fact that both of these men are likely agents in the cover-up of the real cause of the downing of Flight 800. This continues to haunt them, and because they covered that up, they had to cover up other things, which then endangered Americans because steps were not taken that should have been taken to prepare against an operation such as Project Bojinka, which was a plan uncovered by Filipino intelligence regarding a Muslim separatist terrorist group in the Philippines to hijack airliners and fly them into targets in the United States. And that was discovered by Philippine intelligence and given to United States intelligence in January of 1995. And yet, in 1996, in July of 1996, Flight 800 went down. We believe it was an act of terrorism, and yet the government did not take active measures, did not alert the public to a possible terrorist threat because they wanted to protect Bill Clinton's reelection chances, and then buried that information as deeply as possible so that the Bush administration did not have it available when they took office in 2001, and later that year, the 9/11 attacks occurred.
That's a pretty good summary, Tom. And my own, you know, what I've discovered, I would have thought that, you know, as soon as the Bush administration took over, they'd know. But they didn't. I've talked to people very high up in the administration who and I could tell just by their body language when I'm talking to them about this, it's like all news to them, you know?
Right.
But because it was so deeply buried. Now, the architect of that burial was none other than Richard Clark. And in his book, in the most wonderfully indiscreet part of the book, he talks about going to, and this is how bad he is in his details. He said, you know, I flew up to the hangar where they were, they were investigating the crash, where they were reconstructing the plane in Bethpage, Long Island. Well, the hangar was in Calverton, Long Island. It's 60 miles away.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I'm sorry, it's the kind of mistake that just makes you wonder whether he ever went there at all, you know?
By the way, Jack, I don't think this was ever covered in WorldNet Daily. I did some research on this and could never follow the trail far.